Excuse me, I've got a cold, and I just got back from the long run yesterday, so if you can't understand me or I'm a little bit confused, I apologise in advance, and please just tell me to explain myself, but I'll do my best. I also don't have a handout today because there was too many people waiting for the photocopiers, and it's not possible to do it, so we've got a few problems, but we'll try and get through them. Right, today I'm going to talk about art history. So we're going to get, in the next two lectures, it's going to get a little bit more kind of, I don't know if practical is the right word, but anyway, I'm going to talk more about art history, rather than, let's say, the ontological and aesthetic framework for Deleuze and Guattari's discussion of art. And this week, I'm going to, at least at the beginning, talk about the way that Deleuze, particularly I think we can say this was Deleuze's interest, mainly. But anyway, Deleuze and Guattari's use of the expressionist tradition of German art history. Could someone just close the door, please? Thanks. The expressionist tradition of German art history that emerges in the second half of the 19th century and then carries on into the early part of the 20th century, and particularly the work of these three art historians, Eduard Riegel, Wilhelm Boringer, and Heinrich Wolfflin. Riegel was a Viennese art historian who worked at the Kunsthistorisches Museum and also then was one of the founding curators at the Mack Museum. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later on. I'm going to talk a little bit about Riegel. I'm not going to really talk about Wolfflin at all, although for those of you who are interested, particularly the book on Leibniz, The Fold, has got quite a few references to Wolfflin in it. But I'm mainly going to talk about Boringer, who is certainly, let's say, the one who is referred to most often in Deleuze-Guattari's texts. And the two books, he wrote more than two books, but the two books that Deleuze and Guattari refer to are Abstraction and Empathy, Abstraktion und Einfühlung, from 1907, and Form and Gothic, Formprobleme der Gothic, from 1912. So I'm mainly going to concentrate on those because they're the ones that are most often referred to by Deleuze. For those of you who have read some Deleuze, you'll know that Voringer's concept of the Gothic, the Gothic line, is a very common concept, especially in the later works. Both of these books were translated into French in the late 60s, so presumably Deleuze read them in the French. Okay, so Voringer begins from the presupposition that the work of art is, he says, an autonomous organism that develops according to its own immanent rules. So we've already talked about how this is Deleuze's concept of sensation, is that it is a living being. And so a lot of this more specifically artistic writing from Deleuze is going to be directly drawn from Voringer. The most fundamental of these immanent rules are abstraction and empathy, which are the two poles of artistic production, and together, Voringer says, form a comprehensive aesthetic system. These poles, abstraction and empathy, are transcendental and ahistorical inasmuch as they encompass all art, but they find their specific historical shape within actual art movements and styles. So again, this is similar to what we've already discussed, this kind of relationship between a transcendental, perhaps you could say virtual, poles and their actual appearance within historical art movements and styles. Waronger develops his opposition of empathy and abstraction in relationship to classical and non-classical forms of art. Classical art uses empathy, and non-classical is forms of abstraction. These two forms of art are different expressions of a will to art. This concept of the will to art, or Kunstwollen, comes from the Viennese art historian Alois Riegel, who worked in the late 19th century. Riegel regarded artworks as symptoms of a historical people's experience of space, time, and matter. So in this sense, the artwork is a kind of an expression of an ontological, let's say, state of mind. This is a quotation from Riegel. "The character of this will is always determined by what may be termed the worldview of the time." So a people's or a culture's will to art is an expression of a culture, of a worldview. And this expression, the expression of the artistic will of a people or a culture, could only be interpreted by disregarding the more obvious representational or symbolic intentions of the work, and by suspending judgments of value. There's another quote from Riegel. "The mission of our discipline," he said, talking about art history, "is not simply to find the things in the art of the past that appeal to modern taste, but to delve into the will to art behind works of art and to discover why they are the way they are and why they could not have been otherwise." So the idea is to regard art not for, let's say, the things that we appreciate. So in other words, not to appreciate classical sculpture because of its representational accuracy, but instead to interpret mostly the formal aspects of art as direct expressions of something deeper, of a kind of a will of a people, of the people's kind of attitude to living and life. Kunstwollen is therefore a tool for the rigorous analysis of formal qualities that moves beyond the art object in order to understand its ontological commitments. One of the most important implications of this idea was that all aesthetic expressions embody a will to art, which can therefore be discerned in cultural objects such as crockery or architecture as much as in high art. So again, there is no... It does away with the sense of value in art history, which is a very important moment. So it means that in examining art objects in a wider sense, that is, including crockery, architecture, basically what we now call applied arts, that and an understanding that these objects are just as expressive of a people's will to art as, let's say, the highest objects of the culture, yeah, it does away with art history as a kind of value judgment. Yeah. So there is no longer any sense of kind of discerning what is best. It's much more important for Riegel to understand art as an expression of something that goes beyond quality and is ontological in nature. We'll see what those ontological values are as we go. So this was a major change in the traditional art historical account that saw in the Renaissance the final achievement of a representational system capable of expressing human naturalism. Instead, Waronger wrote, this is a quote from Abstraction and Empathy, "the stylistic peculiarities of past epochs are not to be explained by lack of ability, but by a differently directed will." So even later than Waronger, who's writing in the first decade of the 20th century, you know, people often rejected or criticised, say, medieval art because it wasn't representational. So the idea was they hadn't learned how to properly, realistically, and naturally show the human figure. Yeah? And this was actually a criticism of this artwork, and that it was only with the Renaissance that we have really kind of the full return to the glory of Greek civilization and the ability to naturally express the human figure. So this is the beginning now in art history of people saying, well, hang on a second, it's not a criticism of the medieval art that it can't naturally, or that it doesn't naturally express the human figure. That's actually what it was trying to do, and we have to take that seriously and understand what kind of will it was that actually produced this work. So this is an immanent art theory which follows the idea, as Vorongil puts it, that things must be evaluated not from our, but from their own presuppositions. Every stylistic phase represents, for the humanity that created it out of its psychic needs, the goal of its will, and hence the maximum degree of perfection. So we can't judge art from our own perspective, we have to judge it according to its own presuppositions, its own immanent values. Yeah? So we're talking now about a kind of analysis which is no longer taken from our own point of view, but tries to understand the point of view of the people who produced the work. Now, this was an important moment, not just for art history, but also for museums, because, in fact, Regal is instrumental in setting up the Marck Museum here in Vienna, which is the which was the second applied arts museum in the world after the Victoria and Albert in England. So it was a very important institution. And the institution itself, and in fact the tradition of applied arts museums, is really in many ways based upon this idea that actually cultural artifacts like crockery and furniture and, you know, all of these kinds of things that you'll find in the Marck, these things are, let's say, just as interesting from an artistic point of view as are paintings and sculptures and things that are usually collected in an art museum. So the kinds of things that are collected in an applied arts museum are not just, let's say, fragments or tools or the kinds of objects which are often collected in museums. They are understood as having an aesthetic value, but they are understood as being, let's say, equal to art objects in terms of their expressive, the way they express the culture that produced them. The development of transcendental and immanent conditions of artistic production are important for Deleuze and Guattari, who use a very similar argument in the Nomadology chapter of A Thousand Plateaus, where they distinguish two poles of social production, the nomad and the state. These poles, they claim, determine technical distinctions such as that between a tool and a weapon, depending on the social or collective assemblage, nomad or state, that determines them. So it's a very similar kind of way of thinking about cultural artifacts as Regal's. Within the state, a work machine produces tools, while amongst the nomads, a war machine produces weapons. Weapons and tools are therefore consequences or expressions of the collective and machinic assemblage, as Deleuze and Guattari call it. The collective and machinic assemblage that determines these objects' use. So it is the use of these objects which distinguishes them, rather than formal features for Deleuze and Guattari. So in other words, it's not the fact that, let's say, a scythe is inherently a tool because of its shape or because of its form. It's only through its use that it's determined to be a tool. And if, in fact, the peasants revolt, then the scythe can quite easily be turned into a weapon. And this is actually an expression of a changing collective. Yeah? So the collective are no longer workers, they turn into warriors or revolutionaries, let's put it that way. And the tool becomes a weapon. Yeah, the tool is determined, whether the object is determined by its use, by the way in which it expresses the collective that uses it, rather than by any kind of formal aspect. So this is going to be the way Vorongil is going to approach art, that art is not understood according to its representational or even according to its formal aspects, although formal aspects are important, it's determined by what it expresses, by this kind of will of the people that it expresses. All right. So, Waranger's understanding of art according to the poles of empathy and abstraction. Let's start with empathy. Empathy, he says, is an objectified self-enjoyment. This is a definition that he draws from a slightly earlier German art historian, Theodor Lips. This objectified self-enjoyment is a pleasure taken in an object as the affirmation and confirmation of a human will. This human will takes pleasure in our perceptual activity and organic vitality. As Waranger puts it, in the forms of the work of art, we enjoy ourselves. This is empathy. Yeah? So when we see an artwork, what it is we like or enjoy in the artwork is the fact that it reflects our own perception of ourselves as an organic being. So empathy tends towards an aesthetics of organic naturalism, a subjective appreciation of the beauty and a subjective appreciation of the beauty of nature. In other words, it tends towards the representation of the human figure and the human figure's, let's say, organic relationship with the natural world. So it's typified by naturalism and by representation. Here, another quote from Waranger, man was at home in the world and felt himself as its centre. This is the world of Poussin and not of Pollock, where there is a correspondence between formal processes in the work of art and the natural organic tendencies in man. So at the empathy pole, we have an expression of, let's say, of humanistic will. Yeah? And we see ourselves as human beings and our relationship to the world reflected in the artwork. We see our values, our human values, similarly reflected. Empathy allows us, Waranger writes, to be able to enjoy the unclouded happiness of our purely organic being. Now, the problem with the concept of empathy is that it doesn't explain that vast complex of works of art that pass beyond the narrow framework of Greco-Roman and modern Occidental art. Here we are forced to recognize that quite a different psychic process is involved. So there's this enormous amount of art, cultural objects, that simply has not been produced by Western culture and does not reflect this kind of interest in organic being and humanism. Yeah? Now, more traditionally, or let's say older forms of art appreciation, tended, like many forms of, let's say, scientific classification, tended to produce a hierarchy of artistic objects which placed kind of Western humanist art on the top and everything else as a kind of a gradation downwards towards the most kind of brutal and primitive cultural objects. Yeah? This was like kind of Linnaeus's classification of natural objects. This was a transcendent categorization, yeah, that was supposedly reflected a kind of a pure ideal system of God and had nothing to do with what actually was taking place on the ground, as it were. So this is, with Waranger, we see the shift now that he understands, following Regal, that these kinds of other kinds of artworks that don't reflect this kind of humanist interest or humanist aesthetic values are not that they are inferior to Western art, but that they express a completely different kind of will. Yeah, they're a completely different kind of set of commitments on an ontological, social and cultural level. And that we have to try and understand these. We have to try and understand these from the inside, as it were, not from our position on the outside. So, how to understand all of these forms of artistic and aesthetic expression that do not simply try and represent the human figure, the human being, and his or her relationship to the natural world. So, in response to this, we have what Waringer calls the urge to abstraction, which is directly opposed to the empathy impulse. What then, what Waringer asks, are the psychic presuppositions for the urge to abstraction? So what is it expressing? What is abstraction expressing? As with empathy, the will to abstraction expresses a people's psychic attitude about the cosmos. This is another quote from Waringer. Whereas the precondition for the urge to empathy is a happy pantheistic relationship of confidence between man and the phenomenal world that would be exemplified by the Greeks. That's why it would be pantheistic. The urge to abstraction is the outcome of a great inner unrest inspired in man by the phenomena of the outside world. In a religious respect, it corresponds to a strongly transcendental tinge to all notions. This unrest is the product of an immense dread of space, Waringer argues. This state of fear is, in abstraction, the root of artistic creation. Man's fear of the random appearance of the outside world therefore led to a will to abstraction in art, which gave, Waringer writes, the possibility of taking the individual thing of the external world out of its arbitrariness and seeming fortuitousness, and of eternalizing it by approximation to abstract forms, and in this manner of finding a point of tranquility and a refuge from appearances. Their most powerful urge was, so to speak, to wrest the object of the external world out of its natural context, out of the unending flux of being, to purify it of all its dependence upon life. In other words, of everything about it that was arbitrary, to render it necessary and irrefragable, it means indisputable, to approximate it to its absolute value. So, empathy is the art of, let's say, the Western tradition, an art of representation, of naturalism. It shows man and man in his or her relationship to the world. And it expresses a kind of, let's say, happiness in our own living vitality. Whereas abstraction comes from a fear in relationship to the kind of arbitrary and chaotic nature of the world, and tries to abstract from the particularities of the world in order to discover some essential, pure, abstract forms that transcend the world, yeah, to gain a kind of certainty. These two elements have this kind of religious aspect to them, of course, which is the pantheistic nature of empathy and the monotheistic nature of abstraction. This is one of Waringer's ideas that Deleuze and Guattari are not going to pick up, of course, but this is how Waringer sees it. So abstraction is a kind of a will to the absolute, a will to a pure essence, whereas empathy is all about kind of humanity in and of the world. In fact, he's even going to say, Waringer, that empathy is about immanence and abstraction is about transcendence, because abstraction wants to leave the world to find this realm, transcendent realm of pure abstract essences, whereas empathy wants to enjoy, let's say, man in his or her relationship to the world, the accidents of the world, if you like, whereas abstraction wants to deny any accident or particularity. The will to abstraction is a mass expression inasmuch as its artists remain mostly anonymous, whereas with classical humanism, invented by the Greeks and rediscovered by the Renaissance, expression became that of the individual artist and was experienced by the individual through their empathy with the artist and their world. So everything's travelling through the individual, through the human, in the model of empathy, whereas an abstraction, the kind of cultural artifacts that are produced by these cultures who have this will to abstraction, remain anonymous. Because abstraction is exactly the desire to get out of any kind of particularity or singularity towards this abstract essence. So for Waringer, empathy is instinctive and abstraction is rational. Although both offer happiness within the context of the psychic structures which produce them. In abstraction, all the vital elements of life have been purged, all the contingent and uncertain aspects have given way to forms of absolute necessity and law. As such, the aim of abstraction is, Waringer writes, de-organicizing the organic in order to become part of an increasing order superior to all that is living. Abstraction seeks these abstract and transcendent essences of the world in order to express them through an abstract eternalization of existence in the crystalline body. The interesting phrase that he calls this the crystalline body, because of course in Cinema 2 we're going to have a discussion of crystal images by Deleuze, which are going to have some elements of abstraction as Waringer describes it. First of all, crystal images are going to be directly expressive rather than individual, empathetic in the way of the humanist tradition, and they're going to be abstract. Abstraction, of course, is a crucial concept for Deleuze and Deleuze and Guattari. And I'm going to continue on today to talk about the concept of the abstract line, which appears in A Thousand Plateaus, which draws many of its elements from Waringer. Okay, abstraction is the urge, this is another quotation from Waringer, the urge to seek deliverance from the fortuitousness of humanity as a whole, from the seeming arbitrariness of organic existence in general, and the contemplation of something necessary and irrefragable. Life as such is felt to be a disturbance of aesthetic enjoyment. This is an interesting idea. Life is a disturbance of aesthetic enjoyment. Aesthetic enjoyment takes us to something which is no longer organic or alive, but is totally abstract, yeah, and essential. Abstraction, therefore, departs from mimetic naturalism and favours geometric designs or positioning schematized figures on a flat plane that does not imitate space. In fact, for Waringer, Egyptian art is going to be a very important example of abstraction. Deleuze and Guattari borrow this idea of abstraction from Waringer, but they also criticise his crystallization of the abstract line in the most rectilinear forms possible, they say. So they're going to take this idea of abstraction, use it to construct this concept of the abstract line, but they're wanting to break it away from this rigid insistence on geometry that Waringer has. So the abstract line in Deleuze and Guattari is not going to be purely geometric. And Deleuze and Guattari are also going to criticize Waringer because he argued that the earliest art forms were determined by abstraction, particularly Egyptian art, and this meant that in fact it was abstraction that was prior to empathy. Abstraction was the source of art. This was a hotly debated topic of like, when was art invented? When did art first emerge? And Egyptian art was a common answer. And so for Waringer, it is abstraction which is kind of the beginning of art and the basic essence of art, not empathy. Deleuze and Guattari are going to reject that abstraction is the origin of art. They're going to, it's the same with the nomad and the state, they're going to say neither of them comes before the other. You can't say empathy comes before abstraction, you can't say the nomad comes before the state. They're born together and they're kind of poles, abstract, purely abstract poles, that everything that appears exists in a kind of differential relationship of the two. So you can't have one without the other. And they never appear in their pure state, in fact, he's going to say. Deleuze and Guattari also reject Vorringer's rather negative understanding of abstraction as the product of anxiety, in which it's fear that is the impulse for erecting monuments to the eternity of an in itself, as Deleuze and Guattari put it. So they're not going to, Deleuze and Guattari are also going to reject this idea that Vorringer has, that abstraction is a kind of way of trying to combat fear, the fear of the world, trying to kind of create these absolute certainties that we can believe in and that is going to protect us in a way from, let's say, the contingency and chance of the world. Okay. So these are it's very typical, I've often talked about this, but Deleuze and Guattari, you know, they draw on people, but it's a selective reading that they make. So although Vorringer is very important for them, there are elements of his argument that they are going to reject. As a result of abstraction, Vorringer argues, the forces of the world are taken out of their natural context and are shown in their essence, in their purely mechanical aspect, as geometrical and abstract repetitions, both universal and necessary. This means the strict suppression of the representation of space and the single form in order to separate the object from the world and to isolate its abstract essence. So it means that the will to abstraction often produces decoration, yeah, because it is the repetition of an abstract motif, say, around the edge of a cup, or as decoration perhaps in an architectural sense. So it's this eternal repetition of the same, which is a kind of insistence upon the purity of this form that transcends any kind of contingency of life. In his isolation of the poles of empathy and abstraction, Vorringer achieves for aesthetics a Nietzschean revaluation of values. In fact, that's a term that Vorringer explicitly uses, that he is producing a revaluation of values, and it seems like Nietzsche was an influence. So he's revaluing the values of art. So he's no longer, I've talked about this before, he's rejecting this idea that there is any kind of hierarchy amongst aesthetic production, that the Renaissance and the Greeks were somehow at the top and everything else is a degradation of that. He's willing to say that all art is of equal value, it's just produced according to different wills to art. Like Nietzsche, Vorringer finds the value of aesthetic value in the will to art, understood in its onto-aesthetic antipodes of empathy and abstraction. We remember for Nietzsche is going to revalue all values according to the will to power, and the will to power is going to be expressed in terms of two values, active and reactive forces. So you can say Vorringer's abstraction and empathy is not exactly the same as active and reactive forces. We have to remember that. But this idea of revaluing values is very close to Nietzsche. This revaluing of aesthetics in ontological terms is clearly very important for Deleuze and Guattari. But nevertheless, Vorringer's duality of empathy and abstraction is not sufficient for them, because the abstract alternative to classical organic representation relies purely on an appeal to transcendent essences. So obviously, Deleuze and Guattari are going to reject a kind of organic expression, a humanist expression. They're not wanting to try and escape this idea of art as the expression of the human. But at the same time, they're not really interested in an expression that of transcendent and eternal values either. So that again is not what they're after. So something, they're going to have to find something else within Vorringer's scheme that isn't just simply reducible, let's say, to one of the two abstract values. So in the end, Deleuze and Guattari are going to replace Vorringer's opposition of the empathy and abstraction with what they call the more primordial duality, it's their words, primordial duality of the smooth and the striated. Now, this is happening in a couple of chapters in Anti-Oedipus, the nomadology chapter and then the smooth and striated chapter, which come after each other. And this is explicitly the argument. They discuss Waronga at quite some length there, and they say, well, in the end, empathy and abstraction, it's not enough, and we're more interested in this kind of deeper duality of the smooth and the striated. So to understand this primordial duality, as Deleuze and Guattari call it, we actually have to pass through another of Waronga's concepts, which is what he calls the northern line, which is in fact going to be the Gothic line, which is what Deleuze and Guattari spend a lot of time discussing, and Deleuze in the book on Bacon as well. This northern line, it's northern because it is emerging in northern Europe. This northern line, Waronga argues, like I said, it's a concept that does come from Waronga, is an abstract line that is no longer a crystalline expression of transcendent values, but has become mobile in, Waronga says, an uncanny animation of the inorganic. An uncanny animation of the inorganic. Now, strictly speaking, abstraction, in the pure sense of its, in the pure sense of the word, is unmoving. Yeah? It's just the repetition of the same thing. It's not animated by any kind of vitality, because it's actually opposed to the vitality of empathy, to the organic vitality of empathy. So Waronga is going to find a kind of an exception to his strict double distinction between empathy and abstraction, and that's going to be this northern line, Gothic line, which is going to kind of take some of both. It's going to partake of both abstraction and empathy. The abstract line, that's of course the concept that Deleuze and Guattari are going to develop at length in the Smooth and Striated chapter, this abstract line is therefore divorced from organic life, but, as Deleuze and Guattari put it, is all the more alive for being inorganic. So the abstract line is going to be an expression of inorganic life. Deleuze and Guattari, a very important concept in their work. The abstract line of Gothic art, Waronga argues, expresses what he calls the cloudy mysticism of the German peoples of Northern Europe. It's cloudy because it never achieves the clear necessity and regularity of a transcendent abstraction. And so rather than achieving the stillness of eternal form, its search for essences inspires, and this is Waronga's very beautiful phrase, it inspires an ecstasy of movement. So, in other words, the Gothic line is a kind of a search. The Gothic line is a search for an abstract transcendent essence. But it's a cloudy mysticism because it never achieves it. There's too much movement remains within it. We could almost say there's too much kind of living organic life within it, even though this organic life has been removed from the representation of humans and the human world. But there is this, you know, anybody who's seen Gothic art, you can see the kind of way in which it reflects a certain kind of plant life. Yeah? There's a certain sort of biological vitality about the Gothic line, which is exactly what Waronga is interested in. It's a kind of, it's both vital and moving, but it's also abstract. So it kind of straddles the two categories. So Waronga argues that this ecstasy of movement does not represent an organic thing or an ideal and transcendent essence, but expresses a hybrid will in which empathy turns away from the human to discover the mechanical laws of what Waronga calls a living matter. This is exactly the point that Deleuze and Guattari are going to pick up, because they're interested in what they call a vital materialism, a kind of living matter which they're going to call inorganic life. (Clears throat) So these mechanical laws determine the living movement of forces that constitutes inorganic life and construct, as Waringer puts it, the vitalized geometry. It's a phrase that Deleuze likes very much, and he quotes it often. It constructs the vitalized geometry of the spirals and turbines of the Gothic line. Gothic art carries us into an infinity constructed by the mechanical forces of an imminent inorganic life. The infinity of the abstract line, in other words, is none other than our own. Once, as Waringer puts it, we lose the feeling of our earthly bonds and we emerge into an infinite movement which annihilates all finite consciousness. This is a quotation from the book Form and Gothic, which is, I totally recommend it to anyone who's interested in Gothic art or even in this sort of art history of art history itself. It's an absolutely fantastic book. In the Gothic abstract line, Waringer writes, northern man finds himself only by losing himself. This is another phrase that Deleuze echoes many, many times. So northern man finds himself only by losing himself, by going out beyond himself. So it's a kind of movement of overcoming in the northern line, that man creates this line which expresses nothing except for the way he overcomes himself. In this beyond, Waringer says, in a good description of Gothic art, this is Waringer, everything becomes weird and fantastic. I mean, we only have to see the pulpit in the St. Stephen's Cathedral, which is absolutely outstanding and one of the most famous examples of Gothic sculpture, to see this kind of weird and fantastic world that is expressed by the Gothic line. You can't help yourself. You look at that thing and you just think, what were these people thinking about? You know, like, what's that? These old guys. I mean, okay, anyway, you can go there and check it out. So it's pretty good. It's pretty good. It definitely is good evidence for the theory, you know, that people in the Middle Ages were all tripping permanently because of this bacteria that was infected the wheat that was used in the bread. I don't know if you know about this theory, but some people say Gothic art and so forth and so on. It's totally psychedelic, actually, for real, because there was some kind of biological factor in the wheat which caused hallucinations. It's a nice idea. They should kind of start baking it again.
I think it was Muttercorn, wasn't it?
Something
it
is.
It was hot like this.
Yes.
Muttercorn.
Something like that.
In the bread.
In the bread. It could be a good alternative to kind of financial gloom of the present day. All right. Okay, here we are beyond representation because we lack all measure. This is Waringer's argument. Just as we are beyond human subjectivity in what he calls an inorganic intoxication of constant movement and variation in which, again Waringer, we lose the feeling of earthly bonds, we merge into an infinite movement which annihilates all finite consciousness. The one who constructs expressions of this inorganic life, the artisan, as Deleuze and Guattari call him or her, follow the flow and movement of material and its forces. So Deleuze and Guattari are going to take this idea of the northern line, the Gothic line, which is not purely empathy or abstraction, and they're going to develop it in terms of what they call the abstract line, and they're going to develop it also in terms of this figure that they call the artisan, who's a kind of a replacement for the idea of artist, yeah? Which, you know, is kind of logical considering that Waringer's discussion of aesthetic expression is much wider than simply what we call artworks. Yeah? It takes in Gothic cathedrals, it takes in elements of material culture, like, you know, just applied arts and so forth and so on. So the artisan is this figure of artistic expression or of aesthetic expression of inorganic life. The artisan follows the flow and movement of material and its forces. In fact, the artisan is immanent to the matter flow, and inasmuch as all matter involves minerals, Deleuze and Guattari call him or her a metallurgist, one who works with metal. Metallurgy is concerned with the singularities of matter, with hardness, weight, colour, so it's very abstract. It's concerned with these singularities of matter and the operations of deformation or transformation that any given material can undergo, as well as the effective qualities or traits of expression corresponding to these singularities and operations. So all these elements are combined. So Deleuze and Guattari are going to say very explicitly that expression is material, that it is a tray of expression, is a material tray of expression, that aesthetic expression occurs when the material turns expressive. That's in fact what the artist does. The artist turns the material expressive, or the metallurgist. This provides another abstract understanding of aesthetic expression, which no longer appears in representations or symbols, but in what Deleuze and Guattari call a technological lineage emerging from certain materials and forming what they call a machinic phylum. A machinic phylum is constituted by, this is what Deleuze and Guattari say, it's constituted by a constellation of singularities prolongable by certain operations which converge upon one or several assignable traits of expression. The particularity of singularities and operations express a matter flow on the one hand and the desire of the social assemblage that produces them on the other. And together these constitute different machinic phylums. So the machinic phylum is on the one side composed of matter and forces and the immanent potentialities of that matter to be worked and transformed and to be combined with other materials and so forth. And on the other hand, there is the social assemblage, that is, the desire of the social and cultural group which manipulates these materials. And the combination of these two elements is what produces expressive traits, or let's say, the meaning and function of the work. So there are many different machinic phylums, so you can analyse cultural production in terms of these different machinic phylums, which are composed not simply of, let's say, the representational elements of the object, but are composed equally of material aspects and expressive aspects. Yeah, so function and so forth. Not just form, but also function and so forth and so on. So the social context is not simply, let's say, expressed within the forms of the objects, but is also expressed in the way that the material has been used within the process of manufacturing the objects. The production of tools and weapons, for example, I think I've talked about this example, can involve the same material and the same techniques, but exhibit very different traits of expression according to the assemblage of desire that has produced them. Deleuze and Guattari write, at the limit there is a single phylogenetic line, a single phylogenetic lineage, a single machine phylum, ideally continuous, the flow of matter movement, the flow of matter in continuous variation, conveying singularities and traits of expression. But it is not realised in the here and now without dividing, differentiating. We will call an assemblage every constellation of singularities and traits deducted from the flow, selected, organised, stratified, in such a way as to converge artificially and naturally. An assemblage in this sense is a veritable invention. So on the transcendental, in terms of the transcendental field, let's say, there is this continuous flow of matter force, which is in continual variation and which is continually giving rise to expressions of itself. But this is a kind of virtual and transcendental field which is actualized in, let's say, actual cultural objects. And there are various assemblages which actualize this flow of matter and movement. So each historical and cultural, let's say, machinic phylum draws from this transcendental field of this continually varying matter flow in order to actualize it within given cultural objects. Assemblages cut the phylum into distinct lineages, while the phylum cuts across the assemblages, causing them to change and transform. So again, this is kind of this re- and deterritorialization movement. So the absolute, the flow of matter force is absolutely deterritorialized. There is no objects in this flow, but it is re-territorialized onto objects. But these objects, or these phylums which produce these objects, in turn are deterritorialized into the matter flow and then re-territorialized in a new direction, which is where invention would come from or change.
What's phylums?
Phylum. A phylum is like a name for a kind of a cross, for a range of things which can be understood according to this combination of matter and expression. So a phylum is a way of understanding, let's say, material production, which is not simply resting on ideas like, you know, the individual who made it, or a direct cultural expression, because a phylum might take in more than one culture, or it might move between cultures. In fact, socially, the metallurgists were usually people who had relationships with various cultures and empires. They didn't necessarily belong to any one of them. They were kind of transition figures or hybrid figures that caused communication between communities. So, in other words, a phylum is a kind of an abstract way of understanding a material production, which is not simply kind of tying it to direct historical or cultural factors. It's a more abstract way of understanding a kind of a lineage. Yeah. So the phylum would be a kind of transcendental understanding of a form of production, and it could appear in various times, in various places. Yeah. It's more about a mixture of the form of the materials and forces and the kinds of expressions that they produce. This allows us to locate within matter movement abstract machines determining processes of formation or transformation. These machines operate outside the limits of space and time, in other words, they're transcendental, producing events such as ablation, which is a surgical removal, adjunction, which is adjoining without overlapping, projection, and so forth and so on. So these very abstract events, right? These are events that happen to this moving matter. So this is what the machines do. They produce these abstract machines. They produce these abstract operations on the flow of movement, the moving flow of matter. Yeah? And they are inseparable from expressive or intensive qualities of this matter. In other words, its resistance, hardness, weight, colour, and so forth. This gives us a very different understanding of aesthetic processes from that of a fixed form and a homogeneous matter, which we find, of course, in Aristotle's hylomorphic model, which is kind of the classic model for representational art. Yeah, this is the model, one of the models that was taken from Aristotle by the Renaissance. In the hylomorphic model, you have matter, understood as a homogeneous matter, and then you have form, which is an abstract form, and the abstract form is applied to the matter in order to produce an object. Deleuze and Guattari follow the critique of the hylomorphic model given by the French philosopher Gilbert Simondon, who argued that when matter and form are thought of as separate things, the process of individuation is a simple operation for molding, that denies the immanent and perpetually variable continuous modulation of matter force. In other words, the holomorphic model is just a kind of a mold. You have the ideal form and you just kind of use it like a stamp that just produces identical objects. Yeah? But the idea of Deleuze and Guattari is that you have a perpetually variable and continuously changing flow of matter force, and it is this changing and variable matter force which produces always different expressions and objects. That the metallurgist modulates this matter flow in order to pull, using abstract machines, pulls expressions of this variable matter flow from it. On the one hand, there is an energetic materiality in movement, carrying singularities acting like implicit forms that are topological rather than geometrical. In other words, they describe a relation rather than describing a form. And these combine, the energetic materiality and the implicit forms, they combine with processes of deformation. In other words, they are always also in the process of themselves changing. On the other hand, there are variable intensive affects that are inseparable from and express these material movements. The artisan or metallurgist therefore follows a material expressing its immanent energies in affects. Deleuze and Guattari say the artisan or metallurgist, by connecting operations to a materiality instead of imposing a form upon matter, addresses less a form capable of imposing properties upon a matter than material traits of expression constituting affects. So the artisan doesn't impose properties upon matter by imposing a form on matter. The artisan follows the movement flow in order to produce, let's say, expressions of that flow, which then constitute affects for those who contact with those objects. So this is a kind of the inorganic life that Deleuze and Guattari are talking about. It. This process of forming objects from the matter flow and the affect that these objects have on others, this is, if you like, a living being, all of these things together. This is the development or the life of a living being which is both material, it has a form, it is an expression, and it produces affects. And all of these things together form a living being understood in terms of what Deleuze and Guattari call inorganic life. In metallurgy, aesthetic operations move across thresholds, following energetic materiality as it overflows prepared matter and produces qualitative deformations or transformations that overflows form. Artisans and metallurgy brings to light a life proper to matter, a vital state of matter as such, this is a quotation from A Thousand Plateaus, a vital state of matter as such, a material vitalism that doubtless exists everywhere, but is ordinarily hidden or covered, rendered unrecognizable, dissociated by the hylomorphic model. Metallurgy is the consciousness or thought of the matter flow, or, as Deleuze and Guattari call it, the phenomenology of matter. For Deleuze and Guattari, the prodigious idea of non-organic life that Vorringer considered the invention of the northern barbarians was in fact, they say, the intuition of metallurgy. In other words, non-organic life is a term that comes from Vorringer. Vorringer uses the term. But Vorringer gives it, if you like, to the northern peoples who are responsible for Gothic art. So Deleuze and Guattari are going to take this idea of non-organic life, but they're going to give it to metallurgy, which is, of course, something which exists from, you know, the beginning of, well, what comes after the Stone Age? There's the Stone Age, and then there is the Iron Age, right? So, from the beginning of the Iron Age onwards.
No,
I
don't know it in English, it's bronze.
Bronze.
Oh, Bronze Age was first.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, and I think bronze is already a combination of two different metals, right?
Copper.
So, the metallurgist basically emerges from that time. The metallurgist produces aesthetic objects in which, this is another quote from Deleuze and Guattari, in which a dynamic connection between support and ornament replaces the matter form dialectic. Nomad art follows the connections between singularities of matter and trays of expression and lodges on the level of these connections, whether they be natural or forced. The point being that, again, it comes back to this original idea of a will to art, that the form and the decoration are anyway inseparable. They are both expressions of a, let's say, of a manipulation of matter, which expresses anyway the inherent qualities of that matter, right? The weight, the malleability, the colour, and so forth and so on, as well as expressing a cultural will at the same time. So they talk at some length about the decoration of weapons amongst the nomads and how these are sort of as expressive as the objects themselves, and they express the kind of vitality and movement of the nomad peoples and so forth and so on. The material vitalism of non-organic life is expressed in nomad art and its successes, Deleuze and Guattari note, barbarian, Gothic and modern. So this kind of expression of non-organic life in what they call nomad art is something which can occur at any time, including our own time. And in actual fact, as we'll see, they are going to name Jackson Pollock as a modern example of this abstract line or nomad art that experiences non-organic life or that expresses non-organic life. But we can also understand Deleuze and Guattari's point, and what they say is their deviation from Waranger through their respective discussions of the Gothic cathedral. Waranger argues that Gothic architecture is inorganic because the mechanical energies of the stone that it releases are not material but mystical. Gothic architecture expresses these abstract and spiritual forces of transcendence despite the stone by negating stone's material properties. So the Gothic line that we see in Gothic architecture, Waranger argues, expresses a non-organic life precisely because it tries to transcend human life. You remember he calls it a cloudy mysticism. It's an attempt to find these abstract essences, these pure abstract essences, but its very vitality is a mark of its failure, a mark of its kind of constantly falling back, never actually arriving at these unmoving pure essences. It's almost as if for Waranger, Gothic art is this constant process of kind of moving towards without actually arriving. Yeah? And this is the nature of Gothic art's inorganic nature. It's leaving empathy. It's a leaving of the human. Yeah? But it never arrives. It never gains the pure abstraction of essential abstract values. So, Gothic architecture is a kind of a negation of its own materiality. I mean, this is a very common kind kind of art historical reading of Gothic art. So that's the wonder of the Gothic cathedral, right? Is that it seems to deny its own materiality. And we know in an architectural sense, you know, it places the support for the internal vault on the outside of the building, so that when you're inside the Gothic cathedral, you just can't believe that the space could be constructed out of these, you know, that it could support itself on these incredibly fine kind of pillars and so forth and so on. And so we know that's architecturally because the main support of the space is placed on the outside of the building. So the effect of the cathedral itself is a kind of a negation of its own materiality, because it seems as if it's impossible that the stone could actually support this space, this kind of vaulting ceiling, this kind of evaporation that you feel when you enter into the cathedral. Now, Deleuze and Guattari are going to interpret the Gothic cathedral in a very different way. And they're going to focus on the fact that the Gothic cathedrals were constructed according to what they call a nomad science, which means that they were not constructed using off-site and on-paper plans, which is the way that we understand buildings as being constructed these days. You draw up the plan, which is on a piece of paper, and which you do at the office or wherever it is, on a computer, I guess. And then you build the building according to the plan. This would be like the hylomorphic way of building a building, right? But Deleuze and Guattari pick up on the fact that actually the Gothic cathedrals were not constructed in this way. Because the thing about doing it like that is that you assume that the matter is completely uniform. So, you know, you have an abstract plan, and the only way that's going to work is if the matter is completely uniform. The matter is just simply going to be able to be cut into bits and then constructed into the shape that you've come up with on the piece of paper, right? Then it's going to work. So, like, if it's metal, if it's concrete, obviously you can do that. You just pour in some concrete. You know what the properties of concrete are. They're already determined beforehand. And based on that, you're going to have a solidly engineered building, a building that's going to stand up. But in actual fact, Gothic cathedrals couldn't be constructed that way because the material they used was not consistent. That is, they used mined stone. And neither were the sites consistent. So they couldn't really manipulate the site to the same degree that we can today. So, you know, they couldn't totally stabilise the site. And of course, there's very well-known examples of cathedrals that were never actually able to be completed, because before they were completed there was some kind of bad instability in the land was revealed, and it was simply impossible to finish them. So this nomad science that Deleuze and Guattari talk about means that cathedrals were constructed through on-the-ground projections which took into account the singular properties and forces of each of the material elements. This required, amongst other things, cutting the stones according to their particular position in relation to all the others in the building. And this was achieved by a technique of squaring rather than with a template. In other words, each stone was individually cut according to its position in the building and its relationship to the other stones that had already been put into place. So what they did not do was use a hylomorphic template. They didn't just say, okay, we're going to cut, you know, I don't know, 10,000 stones a metre by a metre square, and then we're just going to put them all together and make this building. That was what they didn't do. What they did was they cut each stone one by one, obviously not one by one, but they cut each stone according to where it was going in the building and what the other stones that had been used, the conditions that those other stones put into place, along with the conditions that were involved with the earth and the foundations and so forth and so on. So, the building, in other words, is no longer a form that defines a space, nor the expression of immaterial and ideal forces. than the way that Vorongil imagines it, but a construction of abstract lines expressing the continual variations of the stone's matter force. In this way, Deleuze and Guattari write, it is as if Gothic conquered a smooth space. The Gothic cathedrals were not constructed through a transcendent plan, and this, perhaps, makes them, in Deleuze and Guattari's terms, atheist. The other thing about the Gothic cathedrals that Deleuze and Guattari point out is that they are built by artisans. There is no division of labour, in terms of an architect. So there is not really an architect in the strict sense of the word. There is a team of probably people that we would call engineers, or people who are much more closely involved in the actual manufacture of the building. So there is not this division of labour in the sense that there is a person who's abstract, who works on a purely abstract level, who just designs the plan of the building. It's like when you make the cathedral, what you're doing is you're involved in the material process of building the cathedral, in the material process of manufacturing the elements which go into the cathedral. Deleuze and Guattari's abstract line is therefore neither strictly abstract nor Gothic in Vorongil's sense, because its inorganic vitality is immanent to its material, transcendental in Deleuze's sense, rather than transcendent. The abstract line, Deleuze and Guattari argue, is a vital force specific to abstraction that draws smooth space. Now, smooth space is a space which is composed in and of the matter flow. It's a space which is entirely related to all its aspects. In other words, it does not measure space according to an abstract striation, as they call it. So we talked about this before in relationship to Bergson, yeah, that it applies also to space. So if we think of Bergson's description of time, time is reduced to space because it's just simply a measure. Time is measured and according to a spatial model. 1 minute is like 1 kilometre. Yeah? So a smooth space also is opposed to this kind of idea of space which is measured by an abstract number. Yeah? And it is a space which is filled. It's a space which is constituted only by the elements which are found within it and according to their expression of the matter flow that they are immanent to. So the abstract line draws a smooth space in which one senses a force and has what Deleuze and Guattari call a haptic sensation. This is the way that we are drawn into this space and become part of it as well. So again, you can see, once we think about that, that when we are drawn into the space and become part of the space, it is also the sense in which this inorganic abstract line is neither exactly empathetic in Vorongil's terms, because we have become part of a kind of an assemblage which goes beyond our human, all too human organicity, but at the same time it's not transcendent, it's not abstract in the sense that Vorongil meant either. It's not composed according to, let's say, abstract forms that are simply placed onto matter. Yeah? This is why they like this idea of the Gothic line so much in Vorongil, because it seems to give the opportunity for a vitality to emerge, which is nevertheless abstract. In other words, the two elements that come from Vorongil. So this haptic sensation by which the viewer is also drawn into the smooth space, it occurs that there's a sense of a force which, Deleuze and Guattari says, happens only by touching it with one's mind, but without the mind becoming a finger, not even by way of the eye. So in other words, it's again, I'm going to talk more about this next week. The haptic sensation is something which is not exactly pure touch, because it does involve something of the mind, but it's not ideal either. It's not just simply an ideal process of relation. This formulation of the haptic is often repeated in the Bacon book, where it's more fully elaborated. The mind participates in what it sees without any distinction of a subject or an object. Again, this is something which comes through from Deleuze's relationship to phenomenology. So there is an idea in which sensation can no longer be understood according to the distinction between a subject and an object. That hapticity, this haptic sensation, is a kind of a joining, yeah, the kind of joining that occurs within the smooth space. The smooth space being constituted precisely by its specific relations, yeah, not by an abstract kind of form or measurement. The mind participates in what it sees without any distinction of a subject or an object in a sensation inseparable from the action of a force. So the sensation is always a sensation of a force, but it's not distinguishable from that force. So the force of the work is going to be an affect. Yeah, it's going to produce an affect in me. But these two things are not going to be separable. They're going to instead constitute, let's say, the movement of a, in the Bacon book, it's going to be called a body without organs, but we could also call it a smooth space. A space which is no longer distinguished by kind of categorical distinctions between a subject and an object. Neither can it be measured by an abstract, let's say, numerological value. It's simply constituted by thresholds. That's what they're going to talk about in the Bacon book. So there will be certain thresholds beyond which you are no longer within that smooth space or within that body without organs. The haptic, for Deleuze and Guattari, is the tactile function of the eye, a grabbing or touching specific to a connective function of the gaze. So they're going to say, for example, that nomad art, it's always viewed close up. You can't stand back. And they're going to say the true painter always paints right up against the canvas, never steps back to have a look at it from a distance. Yeah. So it's a kind of a very material relationship to the work. This precisely because it's non-representative, because representation is always going to imply a distinction between the image and the object. Smooth space therefore emerges through this material participation of the eye, its touch, which constructs visual blocks, that's the name that Deleuze uses for them, visual blocks, by following the inorganic movements of matter forces. The haptic eye produces a metallurgical vision, a participatory modulation of a vital matter as an open-ended work in progress. As Deleuze and Guattari describe it, in striated space, one closes off a surface and allocates it according to intervals, assigned breaks. In the smooth, one distributes oneself in an open space according to frequencies and in the course of one's crossings. So it's going to be specific as well. It's going to be a smooth space is never going to have any relationship to, let's say, a generic. Yeah? A smooth space is always going to be absolutely particular, and it's going to be the kind of multiplicity that Deleuze always emphasizes, which is the multiplicity in which if you change any of its elements, you change the multiplicity itself. So it's absolutely specific. So if any of its elements are changed, the entire thing is changed. Yeah? So it's totally specific. It has no abstract qualities, generic qualities. If the abstract line is the vital force specific to abstraction, how should we understand it in relation to art, and more specifically painting? As Deleuze and Guattari ask, what then should be termed abstract in modern art? Obviously, this is a super important question because modernity is in large part defined by the turn to abstraction, not just in painting. What then should be termed abstract in modern art? Their answer follows directly. A line of variable direction that describes no contour and delimits no form. It's very interesting because they're defining abstraction now through the line, which is not usually the way that abstraction is defined in relationship to modernism. But this is a moving line that has no contour, or that describes no contour and delimits no form. that would be its abstraction. Yeah? It's a vital line, it's moving. This abstract line is immediately referenced to Michael Fried's definition of the line in, quote, certain works by Pollock. This is at the end of the smooth and striated, the section in the smooth and striated chapter called Nomad Art in the Thousand Plateaus. In these works of the so-called middle period, that's the middle period of Pollock, this is the famous, where all the really famous paintings come from. It's the kind of where the splatter is completely it's not related to any kind of figurative attempts which exist both before and after this period in Pollock. The line has been set free and attains its Gothic dimension, an absolutely non-representational line that both expresses and constructs inorganic life. The question of Pollock is a very interesting one. Got a little bit more time. Because many people know that in the Bacon book, Pollock is kind of rejected. And Deleuze argues that Pollock's paintings are kind of, they're too chaotic, they're too tactile, there's too much hand and not enough head, is basically what he says. And they destroy any kind of figure. But unfortunately, they're too wild, they're too chaotic, so nothing can really come out of them, is what he argues. But I think we should remember that, like always with Deleuze, these kinds of arguments, they're always, you can't think them out of their context. And the context in the Bacon book is a discussion, obviously, of Francis Bacon. And in actual fact, this distinction is one that's made by Bacon. And Bacon's paintings are defined by the use of the figure. That's what Deleuze is interested in. So the figure in Bacon is exactly what defigures the human form. Yeah? Deforms the human in order to make this kind of body without organs, as he calls it in the Bacon book, Following Our Toe. So it's only in relationship to this way of painting that Bacon has, this way of deforming the figure, that Pollock is too wild, and on the other hand, he's also going to reject our geometrical abstraction as being too cerebral, too abstract in a kind of thinking sense. So too much eye and not enough hand, he's going to say. So on the one side, you know, Mondrian, etc., is too cerebral, too abstract, and Pollock is too kind of gestural and chaotic, and in between, what Deleuze calls the middle way is Bacon, where you still have a figure, but the figure is a complete deformation and kind of explosion of the flesh, you know, the human flesh. So it's only in relationship to this problem, the problem of Bacon, that Pollock is rejected. Yeah? And we shouldn't imagine from that that it's just a categorical statement that Pollock is no good. Because when it comes to the problem of the abstract line in A Thousand Plateaus, there we're going to see, admittedly, not discussed in a lot of detail, and the reference to Michael Fried in the book on the book that includes the discussion of Pollock is in a footnote. But nevertheless, if you read that discussion of the abstract line, it's hard not to get Pollock coming into your mind, because it really sounds like they're describing the Pollock painting. So for the problem of the abstract line, Pollock is going to be absolutely, let's say, an exemplar, the perfect exemplar. So we can't, it's always about, you always have to think about what is the problem that Deleuze and Guattari are trying to address, yeah? And that is going to determine whether they accept or reject various elements. So there are other places, for example, in What is Philosophy or in The Fold, where Mondrian is going to be privileged and is going to be spoken of in a positive way. Again, because the problem is different. So when the problem is different, then it's possible for certain things to be affirmed in a way that they cannot be affirmed in relationship to other problems. The other element of the affirmation of Pollock at this point, which is also important, particularly as we go on to think about Deleuze and Guattari's relationship to modernism, is going to be the relationship to Clement Greenberg. Because Clement Greenberg, of course, was the great, champion of Jackson Pollock's work, and is also, more or less single-handedly responsible for what we would understand as being 20th century modernism, at least in relationship to painting. And their relationship to Greenberg is problematic, I would say, in two senses. First of all, as you would come to expect, or as we've come to expect, they accept some things from Greenberg and they part ways with Greenberg in other senses, which is interesting in itself. But perhaps more dramatically, we can understand that, I think it's fairly clear that contemporary art has emerged almost entirely as a theoretical rejection of Greenberg and Greenbergian modernism. So if we think of, what I would argue would be the three major constitutive elements of contemporary art practice, so we would have site specificity and installation, performance practice, and conceptuality, then all of these elements emerged in the 60s as a direct rejection of Clement Greenberg and Michael Fried. So, again, this kind of problem we have with Deleuze and Guattari of locating their aesthetics and their art history in relationship to contemporary practice emerges very strongly at this point, because they're going to say, or at least Deleuze is going to say, some quite sympathetic things about Greenberg, or more than sympathetic, and he's even going to say that Greenberg's great concept of opticality, which in effect is a transcendence of materiality, at least in Greenberg's writings, which you would expect Deleuze and Guattari to reject, Deleuze actually says in the Bacon book, perhaps this is just a disagreement over words, right? So in other words, not a disagreement at all, it's just kind of unfortunate terminology that Greenberg uses. And it's clear that there are various elements of Greenberg that obviously appeal to Deleuze, especially his use of Kant and the idea of an immanent critique. So Greenberg's idea of modernity is that every artistic genre distinguishes itself from the others by understanding what its own essential elements are, yeah, in distinction to all the other art forms. That's basically when an art form turns into this investigation, it has attained modernity. Yeah? So for painting, what distinguishes painting from any other art form is two-dimensionality and colour. Yeah? These are the two aspects of painting which it does not share with any other art form. So painting, when it attains modernity, rejects all narrative, all representation, and all all kind of use of figures and so forth and so on, in fact, line, just launches itself onto an investigation of its own essential aspects, which is flatness and colour. Yeah? This is the history of abstraction. And I think Deleuze has some sympathy for this, mainly because it's a way of approaching materiality. So it's basically the way that painting now is just understood as an exploration of its own materiality, it's the aspects which constitute it. But at the same time, Greenberg takes this form of immanent critique from Kant, but he also has a very Hegelian understanding of it, because it's a process which leads inevitably to the essential nature of painting itself. Yeah, a little bit like absolute spirit comes at the end. And unfortunately, the historical trajectory of modernism kind of overran its own goal. So when you get to the 50s and you have the emergence of these pure white paintings, unpainted panels, pure black paintings, and so forth and so on, Ed Reinhardt and Noland and Robert Ryman and so forth and so on, it's almost as if modernism has already run its course and there's nothing left. Painting has fulfilled its its mission almost, and yet it carries on. So this was a perpetual problem also for Greenberg, but it's also a problem in the sense that obviously for Deleuze and Guattari it's non-teleological. You can't say that there is an aim that will be achieved, just as you can't say, as Greenberg did, that through the contemplation of these pure material planes of colour, so in other words the effect of what these paintings had, was a purely non-intellectual affect, which Greenberg called opticality, which is a kind of quasi-aesthetic transcendence of the lived body. So, in other words, we attain, through contemplating these paintings, a kind of transcendent optical experience which no longer has anything to do with the body itself. And this is the bit that I think is most difficult for Deleuze and Guattari to accept. But nevertheless, you know, Greenberg is going to call this experience sensation, and Deleuze and Guattari are also going to insist upon sensation as the definition of art. So again, this is the kind of Kantian aesthetics, this idea that aesthetics is a question of sensation, and that's exactly what distinguishes it from other operations. It's precisely this which is going to be the most problematic for trying to use Deleuze and Guattari to understand contemporary art practice, because clearly contemporary art practice no longer understands itself simply in this sense. So clearly, with the introduction of, okay, maybe not performance, maybe not all elements of installation work, but certainly with the insistence upon conceptual practice, contemporary art is going to go beyond its kind of Kantian conditions, if you like. But I'll try and talk more about that next week. Does anyone have any questions, comments? No? All right then, I'll see you next week.